Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
To the AA meeting on air on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. This morning we've got with us the Wellington Newtown Beginners Group. They meet on a Wednesday night in Newtown, obviously. Anyway, we're going to start the meeting with a serenity prayer. So if you'd all like to join me. God.
Grant me the serenity.
To accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Awesome. Now we'll open with the preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We're self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organisation or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Now, this meeting opens with the a reading from How It Works. And so I'm going to just hand over to Adam to read that for us. Thanks, Adam.
Sure, thanks. My name's Adam. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Adam.
This is Chapter 5 from Alcoholics Anonymous Big Book, How It Works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to the simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates, they are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those too who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made lists of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order, I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he was sought.
Hey, thanks, Adam. You're listening to the AA meeting on air. Today we've got the Wellington Newtown Beginners Group, and you're on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. Now I'm going to ask Tim to kick off the sharing this morning.
Sure, thank you, Rebecca. My name's Tim, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tim.
My home is the Wellington Beginners Newtown Group. It's nice sitting in an earthquake-strengthened building. It's quite nice in a small, safe room. You can see the steel. It's actually quite safe here. But I think for me, so what it was like before, what it was like before I had that first drink, you know, my childhood. I've been thinking about that a lot lately, and it was deeply uncomfortable as a child. You know, I was really self-conscious. There was a lot of shame and fear, and it was just of basic stuff. You know, like I had a sister, I grew up with a sister, but older than me, who was autistic, and I grew up before they had those sort of diagnoses, and I was ashamed of her. But it wasn't so much that as that I hated myself for the weakness of that. I knew to be ashamed of a member of your family was the worst thing you could be, and so I had that. It was just, there was so much, it was... Well, shame, like I at school, I was popular with girls, but I wasn't interested in them. It was my mate's mums. And that's just normal, basic human sexuality sort of thing. I found my mate's mums attractive. But to me, there's something dreadfully wrong with me. And I had this shame and guilt, especially because the one I liked the most was Mrs. Marriott. That's Lance's mum. And he was like my best friend. And I just, the guilt, you know, I can laugh about it now. But at the time when you're a child experiencing that, and I was fearful, you know, I had a mother who loved me. But I worried that if the Japanese invaded, she would kill me to no harm, like just that. And I'd worry about quicksand. I'd worry that we lived in an earthquake and there was volcanoes here, and that's really scary. I was going to get out. New Zealand's a really unsafe place, terrifying, you know. And I grew up around, it was violent, but I think in the 1970s, every home was violent. There was no real sexual abuse in my childhood. I just wasn't equipped. I was too sensitive, self-obsessed, and all that. And I can, you know, the defining thing for me is when I was a kid, everyone loved me. I was the youngest of six children, and they all loved me. They were all very scary people because they were volatile and unpredictable, but they all loved me, you know, and that's that. But it was, you know, far too sensitive, you know. And when I was 12, I don't know, baling hay, someone gave me a big bottle of beer. It was Leopard Lager. This was 1982, I guess. And because I was thirsty, I drank that whole large bottle of beer in one go. And that occurs in me that doesn't occur in other people who don't have alcoholism. You know, first of all, the sense of relief was fucking enormous. It was like I relaxed for the first time in my life. Like it felt really, really good. And I wanted more. That physical allergy kicked in. That felt good. I want more. And, I got drunk and I threw up. And I knew the next day, you know, I knew to lie. I knew to say, I'm never doing that again. You know, I knew you were supposed to say that. But I remember thinking, fuck, I'm doing that at every opportunity I can get. And like, seriously, by the time I was 14, you know, booze is a serious problem. Like I went to Kapiti College on Kapiti Coast, of course. And by the age of 14, I'm not at school all week. All I'm thinking about is getting drunk on Friday. And maybe we can get that started on Thursday. That's all I'm thinking about. But the other thing about me is I didn't want to be an alcoholic, you know, because I grew up around that and my father's an alcoholic. And I just desperately didn't want that, and nor did my cousins. You know, all our fathers have alcoholism, and that defined all of us. We did not want to be like them. And I set out to be a drug addict. You know, like I actually, you know, most people, they'll stumble into that life. I set out for that. But yeah, by the time I was 16, booze was causing me problems. By the time I'm 17, it was decided that I was better off in Australia. I remember the whole family, I got a one-way ticket to Australia and $500 and getting packed off there. And yeah, terrifying, you know. But I went around Australia and I got in trouble everywhere. And that was my life, you know. I have alcoholism, you know, that physical allergy. I have that drink, want more. Or I'm obsessed with it. But the intravenous drugs came probably by the time I was 17. But that would stop and start. And I can't tell you with any accuracy about my life. You know, I know I did go around Australia. I've lived in Europe a few times. I don't know whether it's three or four times. I don't know. And, that I was sort of, by my mid-20s, there was a period where I had everything. And it would be a really good idea if I stop now. Like I was pretty much set for life. You know, I was in a really good situation. And my experiences were I would go to detox and I'd always come off heroin habits and detox. And I'd get clean. I'd go through that awful detox. And then I'd pick up again. You know, it would either be booze or the gear. And I couldn't understand that. That's the baffling part to me. At that age, I couldn't. Why am I doing this? You know, I couldn't. But what would also happen is I would have everything. Like I couldn't think of anything more to want. You know, I had the home, a beautiful wife. I had it all, and it would just the longer I stayed clean and sober, it would just seem empty and meaningless and pointless, utterly pointless. The emptiness was overwhelming. And I'd always pick up again. And so at that age, around my mid-20s, I just thought, well, that's my life. You know, I'm in this for the long haul. And, yeah, I got around. I mean, I could tell it was a really interesting issue. I went back to Europe and back to this and all these things. And it was – the truth is, I think, I enjoyed it. I was willing to pay the price. I knew I'd die younger. I would be going to prison. I knew all that. But I think in about my mid-30s, the magic wasn't there, you know. And I was, you know, I had a huge methadone habit by this stage. But my life was utter shit, you know, and it's all slipping away. You know, it was just, by that point, I was just so sick of it, you know, and by my late 30s. And I came to AA, you know, and Adam was there. You know, I came off a huge methadone dose. And I was someone who was told I'd never be able to live unmedicated, that I'd be a danger to myself and society. And they tried to have me sectioned to keep me on drugs, but I didn't. And I came to AA and I had a number of years clean and sober, but I turned my back on it and I walked away. I made decisions based on self, that's the guts of it. And I relapsed and it took me 5 years to get clean and sober again. You know? And that was horrendous. That was the homelessness, the going to prison. Really bad, like an absolute insanity. And looking back on my life, I think the thing that horrifies me most is just how fucking crazy I was for most of it. I'd react to anything, you know, any offence to my ego, you're getting hit right now. But anyway, I don't know how I got sober again last time. I phoned a guy called Neil H. He sort of lent me money to get me out of the immediate shit I was in. But yeah, I just went to AA every day, and I got a sponsor. A guy called Addy took me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is, you know, the way of life, you know, that if I want to continue staying sober and with any peace, that's what I have to live. And yeah, I just do it, you know, I don't muck about with it. Now, I've just had the flu, so I haven't been to AA in 8 or 9 days. I've never done that. I don't willingly do that. Like, I'm quite mad, you know, like I think you've all picked up on that. You know, the songs in my head are louder, you know, like I'm struggling not to start talking to myself or singing, and it's like, I'm quite insane. But yeah, I'm still sober, and I do service. I believe it is an illness of selfishness for me, you know, like it's a journey out of self towards God. You know, I have a spiritual path. You know, I've formed a belief in the soul, which I don't think continues after I die, but that's important to me. You know, I do the things that will nourish my soul, which will nurture that, you know, so the practice of kindness, honesty, and I just do the best I can. You know, I'm a really flawed person, and I've made the mistakes that I won't make again. You know, I don't regret the past. You know, I've learned I've learnt where it went wrong, you know, and I can use that. You know, the relief for me, the life I have now, the importance of it is that I'm actually all right within myself. Like, I could sit here and say, oh, look at my life, it's amazing, because it is. I have everything I could possibly want. But it's not about that. That, if I stop living this as well, life will become empty and meaningless and utterly pointless. You know, that for me, the real purpose is to fit myself, to be of maximum service to God and the people about me. That's where that relief from that awful emptiness within me comes from. So, yeah, it's lovely to be back in a room full of alcoholics again, you know, after a number of days out, yeah, where I've just, yeah, my head's just been away with the fairies, you know, and I'll leave it there. Thanks.
Thanks, Tim. You're listening to the AA Meeting on Air, Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. If you're listening to this and you think you've got a problem with your drinking, you're not quite sure what to do, we've got a awesome website for Alcoholics Anonymous New Zealand. That website's aa.org.nz. We have an 0800 number, which is 24/7. You can call 0800 229 6757, which is 0800 AA Works, I think. And there are alcoholics from the fellowship on the other end of the phone, and you know, there's always someone there to talk to you. So that's pretty cool, we think. Now I'm going to ask Cecile to share.
Hi, I'm Cecile. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Cecile.
Good to be here. I've never been here before. It's quite interesting. I can relate to a lot of those things that were just said. I also felt a lot of shame and anxiety as a kid, but probably about completely different things. And I remember I had a really good, peaceful, ideal childhood. And there wasn't really any violence or abuse or alcoholism. So I've always kind of wondered, like, what on earth went wrong in my brain? And I don't know. And I don't have to know, but I know now what to do about it, which is cool. But I suddenly just kind of got really depressed when I became like a tween. And I'm never really sure why, but so I can relate to those feelings of kind of emptiness and meaninglessness that you hear a lot of people in AA talk about. And that's how I knew that I was at home, because I just heard a lot of people echoing the same things that I've always felt my whole life, such as feeling like a weird person and like alien and never really fitting in anywhere. And I did not have many friends. I was quite lonely, and I just got quite angry and bitter. And it was around 13, 14 that I just kind of started taking my mum's wine and just sculling it in my room. And I also had that feeling of instant relief, like, oh my gosh, like, this is the first time I felt happy, and I want to feel like that all the time. So I keep taking her wine and sculling it and blacking out and vomiting and crying all alone in my room, just being a mess. But I kept doing it, and it was quite puzzling because it often wasn't very fun at all. It wasn't like fun drinking for me. It never really was most of the time. So yeah, it was quite strange that I kept doing it. So that's how I knew that there was really something wrong with my drinking. It was never one or two, and I never wanted it to be one or two. I always wanted to get absolutely smashed. And I know now that if I did have a drink right now, I would definitely drink that same way. There's no other way that my brain lets me do it. And yeah, I was around 16, 17 when I did finally get some friends and go to the parties, and I made an absolute mess of myself in front of people all the time, always crying and just being an absolute mess in the corner, peeing myself, just being embarrassing. And my boyfriend dumped me for that reason. He's like, that's so embarrassing. Why are you always drunk? And I was like, everyone does it. We're teenagers. And so it can be really hard as a teenager to know if you actually have a problem, because people are drinking in quite a rowdy way at that age. So that's the difficulty of being a young person with alcoholism. It's quite confusing. And so it can take a while to figure out if there's definitely something wrong with you. But when I was around 19, 20, that's when it did start to progress into drinking daily. And I always had my like bottle of vodka with me everywhere I went. And that's when things started really kind of falling apart for me. And I did find myself unable to work and unable to leave my house at one point. I became like agoraphobic and I would like have a meltdown if I had to like go outside. And that was really scary. Just having panic attacks and just no self-esteem. And I just ended up in all these really horrible relationships with people who didn't really respect me. And the only thing tying us together was just using substances together and feeling good for a while. And it felt like love, and it's so silly looking back. But that's how I bonded with people, was just substances. And I didn't really know a different way to do it. And I didn't have a clue what self-respect looked like. And I was quite horrible to this one guy I dated who actually did treat me well. I treated him like terribly. And that's probably one of my biggest regrets, I would say. And that's when I did sober up for a while, but it doesn't really last because just stopping drinking is not really enough in itself. And that's why we have AA, because it's far more complex than just stopping. So I did get back. When I started dating someone else who was quite an addict and an alcoholic, I definitely started spiraling down again. Yeah, I did manage to then pick things up, like things picked up nicely, and I was able to go to uni and get a degree, but it inevitably came crashing down again later, and I found myself daily drinking again, so it was something that just kept coming back into my life, as it does. And I'd heard, luckily, so much about AA on like TV and from famous people in interviews, and I did love the things that I heard. So one day when I had this like drunken brain injury at a party because I was being stupid again, I just had this feeling like it was just time to go and that would be really cool. And it was, and I've really enjoyed it ever since. And I too have recently had a week off meetings because I had all this stuff with travel and getting sick, and I can always tell the difference when I haven't been going to my meetings. I feel like an absolute crazy mess. And then when I go, it's just instant relief. I just feel more like a sane person, and like I'm around good company and I can be honest and myself. And I haven't really felt like I can be honest or myself really much in my life. It's always felt like I don't fit in and I can't let people see who I really am, and I have to have this facade and pretend I'm normal, and it kind of goes away in AA, which is really cool. It's take off the masks and it's such a relief. And yeah, I just go into a meeting and I just start rambling about everything on my mind, and it just doesn't matter what I say. It's always well received and I feel like I'm home. And I've had such a nice time getting a sponsor and starting the steps with her, and I really can tell her just about anything, and she's always like, oh yeah, me too. Like, she's been there no matter what I say, and she always has something really helpful to say every time. And I'm starting to learn what it feels like to actually trust something and trust the world and trust people, and to feel like I'm allowed to leave my house and show my face and I don't have to be scared or embarrassed, and like it's possible to live a life without alcohol and be comfortable, because I've always felt incredibly uncomfortable in my own skin, which is one of the main reasons that I did always get so drunk, because I just keep trying to escape that feeling. And sometimes I would just have drink after drink after drink, and that feeling just wouldn't go away, and I would just become a mess instead, without ever really getting that relief that I wanted to. So it was never really a reliable way to even escape that feeling, which is the stupid thing. It didn't really help matters at all, and I'm really excited to be 10 days away from 6 months, which is a major milestone. And so I definitely am so happy that I was lucky enough to get that, this idea in my head to just come along and try it and to just trust that feeling, because it's been serving me really well. And I've been able to make so many amazing changes in my life, and things are kind of falling into place very nicely now. So yeah, I can't speak highly enough about it, and I'm really glad to be here. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks so much, Cecile. This is AA on Air on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. Yeah, and so I guess some of the ways that you can get in touch with AA if you also have a moment when you realise that, you know, this might be the place to find help and recovery. I think I've talked about the 0800 number. We also have an email help address, which is help@aa.org.nz. So, you know, if you need help and need to, you know, an alcoholic to talk you through what's going on or how to find a meeting, but you don't feel like you can actually physically speak to someone, that's another option. Or if you're one of the super brave people, you can just search for a meeting online and show up. And I'm just going to hand over to Adam to share now.
Thanks, Rebecca. My name's Adam. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Adam.
Hi, Adam.
It's really good to be at a meeting, and it's nice to be back at AA On Air. Like's been shared, I really relate to what's been shared already. I am the child of alcoholics who are the children of alcoholics ad infinitum. You know, essentially it's often a family disease, but as Cecile shared, it's not always. In my case it is. My mum's often joked that I'm the end result of generations of breeding, of genetic refinement, you know, down to a point where, you know, trying to create the super alcoholic. But, my mum got, you know, my mum's 30 plus years sober in this fellowship. So my first introduction to AA was when I was 8, when she got sober. And the strategies that I learned, I think, really as a child growing up in an alcoholic home, because my father was too, are strategies that don't really translate well later on in life, but probably helped me out early on, you know, lying, hiding, you know, things like that. Like Tim shared too, you know, I was just very sensitive to my surroundings, you know, hyper-vigilant, hyper-sensitive. And, you know, very sort of dependent on how other people's moods were going was a big part of it for me. And essentially alcohol early on in my life was a solution to the way that I felt in a big way. And, you know, like's been shared, I have the allergy to it where, and it's amazing that it's, you know, I think it takes a lot of us a long time to realize, but certainly for me too, is that once I have that first drink, it's just inevitable I'm going to drink until I can't get any more or consequences, you know, intervene essentially. Yeah, drugs were a big part of my life too. Actually, similar to what Tim shared, I made a conscious decision to become a, you know, a drug user because my drinking was already out of control. And actually, I remember going to see Trainspotting with some friends from school, and they left that film thinking, "God, that's awful," and I left that film thinking, "That looks amazing." So the first chance I got, I tried it, and you know, it was hand in glove, same as alcohol for me, but just a different vibration, but you know, essentially the same problem, supercharged to a degree, I think, and for me, and then that thus began, you know, essentially my adult life of fluctuating between intravenous drug use and alcohol, and I would chop and change trying to control the other one. And the only way I'd ever discovered to control my alcoholism was through drug addiction, which isn't really much of an advertisement for drug addiction. But, so, you know, my 20s essentially progressed in a downward spiral. I ended up as a kind of tourist of everything kind of depraved in, you know, or everything sort of, it was kind of a little bit like, you know, I was homeless for a while, living at the night shelter when I was allowed to stay there. They often used to kick me out. And then I was stealing a lot in order to buy drugs and alcohol. And I even worked as a rent boy for a while, for a very short period of time, but went desperate and ended up in jail when I was, first I had acute liver failure when I was 27. And that was sort of partly that was really my leaving Las Vegas moment, where I barricaded myself in the lounge and, you know, was drinking bottles of tequila and smashing smashing Panadeine as well. And but then ended up in jail when I was 28. And in some ways for me, that was actually a kind of a defining but good moment. I'd already done the rehab thing, and a bit like it's been shared, what I didn't understand was that getting clean or and sober physically was really not enough. It wasn't, and I didn't understand that for a long time. So what I would do is I would be able to detox myself sometimes if I had enough of a motivation. And like Tim shared too, I would get through the awful withdrawal, but then once I felt better, I'd inevitably pick up or drink again. And I didn't understand why that was happening. I did rehab when I was 23, I think I was, and I was down in Blenheim, a place called St. Mark's, and, you know, I can remember I got through the 3 months, but, you know, essentially towards the end of it, what started to happen was I just started to have this feeling of like, I know I'm going to drink. I started getting that urge and that sense that I would. And I managed to do the actual 3 months before I drank again, but I drank while I was still down there. And I can just remember feeling so baffled. I rang up my you know, junkie girlfriend at the time, who was still back in Wellington, and I rang her up, and I was, you know, I was like, I couldn't believe that I was completely hammered and, you know, threatening suicide, which was something I would often do, and crying down the phone. And, you know, essentially it was just the same kind of reaction that I used to get throughout my life, was that even people who had drug and alcohol problems didn't really understand my drug and alcohol use. They used to baffle them to a degree as well. And at various times, you know, I became the drunk that other drunks didn't want to hang out with, or the junkie that other junkies would say, watch out for him, he'll steal your gear. You know, like I became that guy. There was a time when I was homeless, and I was really lonely one night, and I thought, and I did have like a cask of wine, and I thought, well, maybe I'll go hang out with the homeless drunks. And I found them on Cuba Street. And the weird thing was is they essentially rejected me, and I'm not really sure why. It's not like they told me why. I don't know if it was that I seemed just not, you know, maybe I looked a bit too middle class, even though I wasn't middle class. I mean, I was actually homeless at the time, but I'm not sure what it was, but, you know, I managed to sort of befriend one of them, the kind of the worst one, you know, the one that the other ones were scared of. I managed to befriend him, and, you know, I'd never sniffed glue before, and I thought, well, here's my opportunity. So, you know, try everything once, you know what I mean? And I can distinctly remember later in the night, like, I wasn't giving it back, and they started to get really angry with me about, like, you know, give me my glue back. And that was essentially me. Like, I'd get my hands on something, and I just wouldn't let it go. If anything chemical, you know, I can remember coming out of blackouts at parties with someone else's wine, you know, like lying on my back, guzzling it like a baby with a bottle. You know, I just would do things like that all the time and not understand why I was doing them. So fast forward, really, and one of the things that jail was good for was it managed to actually get me clean, significantly clean for a while. And it gave me an opportunity to make some new decisions, which was things like I decided I was going to front up and just admit, go guilty on all the charges I had. You know, I had a lot of theft charges. And that sort of began my first thing with AA, essentially, where, you know, I was amazed that I came into the fellowship, and although I knew about it through my mum, I'd never given it an honest go myself. And at my first meeting, and I was stuck in a halfway house in Upper Hutt, and at my first meeting I walked in there at the Salvation Army Hall, and I can remember there was a big guy there who had turned out he had sports arthritis in his joints, so it was difficult for him to get out of the chair. But I can remember him getting out of the chair and walking to me as I walked into this giant hall, and I felt completely out of place. And he came and shook my hand and said, it's good to see you. And I choked up at the time because I just thought it's been a really long time since anyone had said it's good to see you and actually shake your hand, you know. He ended up being my first sponsor. After that first meeting, he wrote his address down and said, yeah, I should come round. And that also blew my mind because I just finished sharing about the fact that I'd gone out of jail for being a, you know, a thief. And that began my journey with AA and, you know, just the kindness and the time that people end up spending putting into your sobriety is amazing for me. You know, this is my second go at AA. like Tim shared too, I drifted away. I turned my back on AA and let things get in the way of my recovery. I think what I know today is essentially that despite being a lifelong atheist, I know that there is a higher power or a God of some sort, because that's what works in my life when I do it. I'm grateful that there is a program for me, because essentially the thing that I can't do, which I wish I could, is just not drink. If it was that easy, I would do it. I've tried that multiple times, but what I need instead is I definitely need a program in my life. And it's nice at this meeting we always read out how it works, and it sort of doesn't matter how many times I hear it, I always get something different out of it. But I love the last three points, which is so succinct. It's A, we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could relieve our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he was sought. And I think that really sums up what it's about for me, is I know that to be true today. I'm 100% on the fact that I'm powerless over alcohol and that my life's so manageable. So it's good to be here. It's good to be sober today. Good to see you all.
Thanks, Adam.
You're listening to the AA meeting on air on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. There's a little bit of time left. I'll do a bit of a share myself. My name's Rebecca. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Rebecca.
It's really cool. I love doing these Saturday morning meeting on air. Hear some different stories. It's a bit of a different vibe. I really related to a lot of what people have said. That topic of shame, and the way that great sense of discomfort in your own skin that a lot of us seem to have felt as kids, and that just uneasy sense of not fitting in is definitely something that I relate to. I was the kind of kid who would hide behind the Christmas tree and sob all evening, for I couldn't tell you why now, but I didn't belong, I didn't fit in. I always felt like, actually maybe I was adopted. I didn't really understand my peers. I also had a lot of difficulty making friends. I got on better with adults. I couldn't seem to hit the right tone. That feeling of shame, I think I grew up in a family environment where there was a lot of shaming, and we were driven hard, and there were expectations of, we were expected to perform. And, I used to think that the two biggest lies that adults told you were, we just want you to be happy, and and you'll have fun when you get there. And annoyingly, actually, I often did have fun when I got there. I can say that's certainly been true of my sobriety. But we were very much expected to be happy with what our parents wanted us to do, and they did a real living through us, and it was hard work, and I did feel shame at not being good enough, I came across a really cool working definition of shame being the fear that if someone were to really know you, they would reject you. And, you know, that was the shame of my sort of older years, maybe not so much as a really young child, but that was something that really, really followed me, you know, that feeling of terribleness. And I drank to try and find ease, you know, social ease and ease within myself. And then would come shame, and you know, I would do stupid things. I just related so much to what Cecile said, you know, because I was the girl who was crying in the corner at parties as well, or you know, maybe I'd have the nights where I was doing something really outrageous. And then I would have that shame. I thought that all the things that went wrong and my drinking and stuff was like a moral failure, and that I deserved to be rejected, you know. And I held on to that for a really, really long time. I spent lots of time kind of trying to hide these things and present a front, all the while, you know, I knew in my heart that I wasn't good enough. You know, when I finally came into recovery and I learned that it was an illness, you know, that relief was immense. That was the first moment that I felt real relief, that like, I'm an alcoholic and that means that I'm sick, I have a problem. And, you know, I'm okay. You know, there was my first sort of dawning of that. I guess that, you know, it takes a while in recovery to actually be able to believe that, more than just in little flashes and moments, but you know, to be able to get that ease, that feeling of comfort in your own skin, and you know, that ability to be in a place amongst people without feeling like you need to run, is amazing. I also really related to the thing about self-respect. Like, you know, people would say to me, particularly boyfriends, they'd be like, have some self-respect. And I did not know what that meant, except, you know, obviously it's a bad thing. Usually it means that they're about to break up with you. But I did not know how to address that, how to change it, and what self-respect looked like. I think, you know, I had this concept that to have self-respect was to be demanding, and to have emotional needs was to be needy. And you know, these are all things that I had to learn in sobriety. And I am so glad that I have had that opportunity to learn those things and to be comfortable. And you know, at 6 months, you know, that's the point where, you know, you can start to see those promises on the horizon. So it's a super cool, super cool place to be. We're running out of time now. I'm really glad to be here. Thanks for listening to the radio show. Thanks to the people from the Wellington Newtown Beginners Group. Great meeting on a Wednesday night if you're in Wellington. Definitely a good one to pop into. We'll be back next month, and I guess we'll close with the Serenity Prayer. Awesome.
God
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. All right, thanks everyone. That's the AA meeting on air.
Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard online.
That program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.